Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, December 30th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Restorative Practices, Part 2 of the Peace is the Way Retreat, led by Tim Hansen, session number HAT-2003-02. Let's listen in.
Just gave you a copy of some handouts from our resource center that I grabbed that were sort of general about restorative justice. And I have a video clip that I want to show in a little bit as well that'll do a nice job of kind of giving an overall summary of restorative justice. But this morning we talked about sort of some of the history of the current justice system, a little bit of the history of restorative justice, and we went through a values clarification exercise. And so before I show the video, I wanted to talk about a couple of other things and explore with you. You know, for the most part, most of us in society do the right thing. I mean, we're law-abiding, we keep good relationships with one another, we follow, for the most part, the social norms that are set out to keep us functioning in a good way together as a community. Would you agree with that?
Like, we wait in line instead of cutting in?
Yeah, we somewhat obey the speed limits. You know, you haven't stolen Janet's backpack yet, since you've been sitting here for this amount of time.
Which one is it?
Ed hasn't gotten your scarf just yet. You know, we mind one another's personal properties and that sort of thing. Why is that? What forces in our world makes it so that we do indeed function together in that kind of way?
I would guess parenting early on had something to do with it.
Okay, so there's something about parenting.
I was going to say we learn the mores of our particular culture through experience and observing others. That's similar.
Okay.
Cultural expectations or something. Mm-hmm.
An old business associate of mine used to say there's only two motivators, fear and greed.
Fear and greed.
Fear and greed.
Well, if we were to explore that a little bit, what?
Rewards or punishment.
Okay, so for some, this idea of reward and punishment.
I argued with him, but, you know.
I would say also, though, a basic desire for an order is not the best word, but.
Getting along.
Whatever the opposite of chaos is. Mm-hmm. We recognize that if I do whatever I want, anybody else can do whatever they want, and it just doesn't, we can't exist that way. So I don't know exactly how to define that.
That's a principle, I think, that might play in some other things that we say here, what you're saying, Emily, and that it's that classic that most of us will choose fascism over chaos, or fascism over anarchy. Wow. So that might be a deep human urge, a human drive towards keeping order.
So some sense of order.
The primary motivator for me was a feeling of chaos when I made a little violation by, you know, kicking my brother under the table and then hearing just a frown. Mm. But that primary violation of somebody else's body or emotional.
So a frown from him, sort of that.
Well, the violation has to start. I had to make some gross error, and just belching at the table was a gross error.
Okay. Maybe that might fall under the realm of experience, but it's something about what came out of that experience.
Consequences.
The consequences from parenting.
Well, it seems like then, to state it positively, there must be. Suggesting there might be something at work within most of us related to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You know, that somehow we learned that works, something like that works.
Where do you think we learned that from?
Well, so I guess, so if my brother hits me and I don't like that, and then he knows I don't like that, and he learns from that, or that I find out when I've done something to somebody, they don't like that. And how do you know? I still want to be brothers and everything. So,
So there's something about maintaining relationships.
Yeah, I was going to say drive to relationship. I get very unsettled when I've got a broken relationship. I want to keep those relationships intact.
Is the economics of pain caused to others and they cause to you, and you keep track, and you keep, my brother and I kept points.
Really?
For years.
Okay.
Well, you did that to me 3 years ago, and I'm getting you back.
And I still got it.
The word that fits there is retribution, because if I throw a stick at my neighbor buddy, I figure he's going to throw one back.
Yeah, so that kind of falls under this punishment realm. But again, because I'm going to channel just to continue to think that in our own lives, what is it that keeps us functioning? I mean, some of that fear or that sense
guilt.
Of consequences.
Guilt.
Yeah, that works.
Guilt. Okay.
So if I did cut in line, there would be glares, right?
Desire for acceptance.
Okay, so related to guilt is something about acceptance?
Mm-hmm.
Ian or A-N?
Ben.
And disappointment, perhaps?
Would safety be an issue in that?
Definitely. I think there's some sense of safety that I want to know that I'm safe, and so by maintaining relationships, I certainly know that that's one way to do that.
Seems like in our churches we try to instill values to aspire to, and especially at stewardship time.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue is, you know, to raise us up to be good enough to give 10%, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we've achieved some kind of moral value. But it's a moral value. It's something to aspire to. When we lived with the native people in Alaska, the Inupiaq people, and a little boy caught his first fish, he didn't take it home. He took it to his elder, and it wasn't his fish. You learn in those traditional cultures, although they're so impacted now, but you learn, and you still see, that it's not a moral value to be ascended to by a good Christian, or a mystic value that we would have of world communion. It's just a practical survival value. You give that to your grandma or your grandpa because you are being raised up to provide for this community, and if you don't do it, the whole community is going to die. There's no anonymity there. You're all dependent on each other. Imagine living with this kind of snow and the nearest place is hundreds of miles away where there's another 200 people.
Mm-hmm.
And so another value is getting along, avoiding conflict, even when terrible things happen. But they're not these mystical, beautiful things, you know, that we talk about, oh, you know, if you're a good Christian, you do. They're just practical.
Mm-hmm.
Survival, base survival values.
But we still learn them. And I heard you talk about a couple of institutions, per se, churches being one, and family in regards to that young boy. I mean, where did he learn that that's what he was supposed to do?
But there's always this tension when you're the CEO or the CFO of a company of what's practical. And there's no question in a small village in Alaska in 20 below weather of what's practical. What's practical is sharing and avoiding conflict. Now you go to church on Sunday and then you go to work on Monday and you have a tension between values.
You mean here?
Here, right? You go to your work as a CFO and it's, well, you know, my primary value isn't to give away.
Yeah.
I think that's a major piece that exists. Maybe it's the legacy of hunting-gathering cultures that we still try to teach those things. But we're working so hard to teach them because, in a way, they have questionable practicality in our Monday through Friday lives.
So then, could that at least one connection here go to that line where it says relationships, connections, and then for that CEO, whatever, there's some way in which other things, I don't know, you know, money and strata and all these things get in the way of the actual relationships. So that therefore I don't have to care that much about that employee way down the line. I just use that employee.
Well, I think the power differential, the CEOs and CFOs I knew were cared more about their relationship with their shareholders than they did necessarily with the relationship with employees and or even clientele sometimes. And so it was perceived that the shareholders had more power over that CFO, CEO's
right.
experience and enjoyment of life.
Or impact on the environment.
Or what
lots, lots of other connections. Other social forces or systems or structures that keep us doing the right thing?
Were schools mentioned already?
Nope, they haven't been. Thank you. So schools and the impact of teachers.
Coaches,
yeah. Yep. Who else influences you at school?
Peers.
Yeah.
Neighborhood?
Neighborhood? Sometimes talk about that time, you know, when some people tell me I couldn't get from one end of the block to the other if I had done something wrong because my mom knew by the time I got all the way down there the phone lines worked faster, you know, than my running home, so she knew by the time I got there. That sense of, you know, a village keeping watch over in a good way in regards to what's going on. Any others that you would list?
Well, I think as adults, our place of employment, if you either break the law or break any of the norms of the workplace, there are consequences that you learn very quickly.
Okay.
If you hadn't picked it up anywhere else along the way.
Mm-hmm. After we generate this list, I typically ask, in our current way in dealing with conflict, thinking about the formal correctional system, if what we want to do in intervening when there's been laws that have been broken is to make sure that those that doesn't happen again, to make sure that, that we are law-abiding in good relationship with one another. In our current system, formal system, in the way we function with that, how many of the, I mean, we are saying these are the major determining factors in our lives in regards to what keeps us doing the right thing. So we would certainly want to have a way that we utilize all of these in our current system, right? Do we? Which do we access to try to influence behavior change?
Within the correctional system?
Within the formal justice system at this point.
Punishment.
Yep. Punishment is the main focus. What
yeah.
we say, Eric?
Maintaining order. We use a police force to maintain order.
Yeah, to reinforce the order that we've been, but that's typically done with punishment in mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is some access to education in prison.
There is minimal access to education, although I would say in this last year a lot of it has been lost. Mm-hmm. Like in the state of Texas, it's really are basically warehoused. There's very little educational program. In Minnesota, I would say 50% of our educational programs got cut in the last year because of budget cuts.
Yeah, I find it interesting that there's a response from a lot of people like, well, that this person did bad, they're in jail, they should just kind of rot there, and it's like a waste of taxes if they actually got some schooling or
mm-hmm.
something. And
mm-hmm.
who dare they? How, you know, I gotta spend money to get my kid to go to school, you know, so why should we pay for that person?
Right, so we don't access that as a driving force for behavior change very often.
Ed? A word that I noticed is missing is reward.
What was
it? Is it there? Oh,
yeah.
Okay, because thinking of the jail sentence, a reward for good behavior, you know, time off, early out.
Yep, get out a little bit early and
out of confinement, out of solitary, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that certainly has a strong impact on behavior.
But what is the good behavior? Is that simply not getting in trouble?
It's probably living within the norms of that society.
I mean, it's what's amazing to me is how quickly economics plays into that as well. I mean, we're seeing a huge number of people being released early because of economic factors at this point, not because of necessarily good time, bad time.
That we can't afford to keep them there or
right.
buy their way out with a good lawyer.
Right. Either or.
Would another factor in there be restitution, doing restitution, be a way of teaching, you know, you have to undo something that you've done wrong and make it right?
I think where I would see that fitting would be in that sense of experience and maybe in a positive way, consequences in some sort of way. I mean, if I think back in my childhood, if there were experiences in my childhood where I was held actively accountable for what I did and made restitution or made right what I did, I learned from that experience as opposed to just being punished for something I've done and say, don't do that again.
So you paid off the broken window fee.
Right. Either literally paying for a broken window, or one, think of when you were held accountable for something that you did. Mm-hmm. Our justice system would say that we hold people accountable, but all we really look for is a guilt. Guilty or not guilty? Guilty, okay, now we move into punishment. Restorative justice says we look for that same level of accountability, but it's an active accountability. In the restorative justice framework, we'd say, when you admit to having done this, that's just the beginning. It's not the end. It's the beginning to exploring now what needs to happen to make things right. How can you be actively accountable to the consequences of what you did? Okay? And in the restorative framework, where the victim is the center point, the harm that you caused that person is centered, you want to know what needs to happen to make things right to that person and to the broader community. Well, how do you do that? How do you find out what needs to happen to make things right?
Ask them.
You ask them. It's such a foreign concept within our justice system at this point. It's shockingly surprising that we silence the victim and push them to the side pretty quickly as opposed to involving them. We use the phrase involving the three major stakeholders, which are victims, offenders, and the community, as early and as often as possible in the process of defining justice and making amends and making things right again. So until I can find out from Eric what the impact of my stealing his backpack was for him, how can I really make up for that? Or breaking out his car window, you know? In the court, it would be the value of that window was was $35, pay $15, his insurance covered the rest. Okay, let's go on, it's the end. Or talk to a lot of offenders who go, they had insurance, it was no big deal. Who was harmed by what I did? No one. You know, the insurance company. Or hey, they have three CD players at home. I mean, they're so rich, it doesn't matter, so I took one. So, and until there's that sense of connecting with the harm that you caused, you can't move to that point of making restitution or making amends for what happened. And you have to have dialogue and communication, exchange of information before you're able to do that.
And does that in alarms?
Emily's got it.
As you're talking, we talked about it a little bit in the last session, but I see a lot of the need for the court system, quote unquote on the need, but a lot of the need for the court system coming out of our industrialization and hence our move to the city, so that we don't see the taking of an apple from an orchard, that doesn't get reported to your mom before you get home, because nobody notices. We've talked a little bit about the anonymity, but in a small community, there is still a sense of that lack of anonymity, and that is a reason many people leave their small towns, is so that they can be anonymous.
Right.
So that it's not, and it's talked about in a negative sense in the gossip.
Yeah.
But that gossip really has a function in the community.
Absolutely.
Which is, did you know that so-and-so did this? Well, now that person is accountable. Obviously, the backstabbing and all that is a negative, but the accountability that goes along with that, I think, is an extremely healthy part of what's gotten a bad rap in small towns, that everybody knows everybody's business.
Yeah.
Well, everybody knows everybody's business. That's good.
Yeah, it's powerful. So the sense of family, the sense of community, that sense of neighborhood is incredibly powerful. So when I do a conference or a circle where we're trying to come up with a sentence or try to figure out how can this person be held accountable, if that young girl's grandmother is there in the midst of talking about what happened and what needs to happen to make things right, is much more impactful than her attorney.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
or the judge making that sense. So where are the points of power in regards to behavior change in individuals? It's in these, a lot of these things that we don't access through our current formal system. Ed?
Accountability, though, requires an acceptance of responsibility.
Yes.
For a person to spill a cup of coffee and say, and burn themselves and sue the company that made the coffee, ignores the responsibility of that person to carefully treat what they have.
Right.
Put the blame somewhere else.
Right. Right. And in a society where, you know, the quickest rich scheme is to sue one another, and hopefully big corporations, because they, you know, what? So what? Who are you really suing? You know, no one. You're just getting money from someone that has money waiting to give to you, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that's part of that anonymity sort of false lie, I think, that society has pushed us into.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask in your example before. I mean, I'm assuming this process then brings in that the person who was victimized had their CD stolen, and they have three at home. They hear that the other person doesn't have one. And so, I mean, do they say, yeah, I did have an extra one.
Yeah.
Maybe all they want is
And is the big corporation say, yeah, I got too much money.
But it is that sense of relationship building is also core in regards to restorative justice and sharing of information. And so we look at how the offender needs to be held accountable and what the needs of the victims are, but in the midst of that is also what is the needs of the victim, or the needs of the offender.
Right.
What are the factors that led to this? Not in an excusing sort of way, but in a reality sort of way in regards to their life circumstances and their needs.
It was, I think, early this past summer sometime, it was a public radio thing, and they had a couple examples, and so I'm curious if this relates to your experience with this restorative justice. And it was a women's prison, and largely young women. And under someone's tutelage, it sounded like they put together a song and a skit, sort of just for when their moms and grandmas, whoever, you know, that visited. And it was basically, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I let you down so deeply. And then, I mean, these young women were just overcome with sorrow, tears. And there was like this occasion then for their mama to hug them and say, well, we're gonna work this out.
Yeah.
You know, there's a future and everything.
Yeah.
It was really powerful.
Yeah, it was on NPR.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I heard that same series. There is that sense of, by being held accountable, opens the door to self-forgiveness, at least. A lot of the inmates that I work with are so imprisoned inside themselves because they don't get a chance to talk about their offense. I've talked to guys that have gone for years in the prison and never talk about the incident that brought them there. Beyond the pecking order sort of thing. You know, yeah, well, I violently killed someone. Well, I really violently killed someone, so get behind me. You know, there's this whole survival hierarchy that happens within the correctional facility. But to create a space and a time where offenders can truly talk about what happened, and more times than not, they know the exact details, you know, moment by moment, in regards to what happened. And that retelling of that experience opens up the doors, I think, for accountability and eventually for forgiveness, and I think for change.
Was that kind of part of the trying to work restorative justice, not only so there's some kind of relational awareness with people you've offended, I mean the actual crime, but also within your family, people love you.
Right, the reconnecting of those relationships. As I mentioned, our current system is very offender focused. And the questions are typically, you know, if a crime happens, it's really what law was broken, who did it, and what do we need to do with them to make sure they don't do it again? Okay, those are typically the three questions. Mark Umbright at the University of Minnesota summarizes by trail 'em, nail 'em, and jail 'em. You know, sort of that's our typical response in a retributive, punitive sort of mode, very offender focused. In a restorative justice mode, we say there's also the victim. And so we should be asking ourselves, well, instead of what law was broken, it was who was harmed. Who was harmed by this incident? And not just the primary victim, but the secondary victims. I mean, we all know if something happens in your neighborhood, if your window is broken out, it affects your neighbors nearby. I mean, if your son is murdered, of course it affects the rest of the family. So in a restorative framework, we ask, who was harmed? And what do they need? What are their needs? What needs have arisen out of this offense? And then whose obligation is it to meet those needs? And what is that relationship with the offender, again, in regards to being actively accountable? The third stakeholder that we talk about is the community, because it can't be balanced in regards to what is the harm that happens, as Diane was mentioning earlier, that sense of community wellness or community safety. So we look at the role of the community, and we say, what is their responsibility to meeting the needs of the victim and building the competency of the offender as well, and so meeting the needs of the offender? What are their responsibilities back to the community as well? What is the community's responsibility in the deterioration of connections and neighborhoods that this sort of crime happens in their neighborhood? So what is the responsibility there, and what needs to happen? And the hope is that when these stakeholders are all involved as early and as often as possible in defining justice, that there's a working relationship and connection that happens that can result in safety, a broader safety for the community. So we talk about these three stakeholders, and in order for a program to be truly restorative, it involves the community, it involves the victim and the offender as early and as often as possible. So programs such as the one you noted, which was kind of offender focused in giving these young girls a chance to, in a theatrical way or in a communication sort of expressive way, to communicate back to their families. Well, I mean, families are always a victim in the midst of this, but perhaps not the primary victim, and it's connecting them with community. But again, the goal is to find ways where all parties are active.
This is gets into dangerous territory, especially when you start talking about, well, what's going on in the community, the economic system, and so forth.
Yeah.
And how does it all work? How we've had three major corporations move out of here and fire all these people, and a big downturn in economics.
Yeah.
Upturn in the crime.
Yeah. It's big stuff. Yeah. What it says is that it's the simple act of violence between two people isn't an isolated thing that's just simple, that no one's impacted or involved in some sort of way with. And so we say, how can we create a way of dealing with that harm, making things right, that is more mindful of the full picture? But yeah, it can be big, and you can almost move to that point of getting overwhelmed with it. But the challenge is to kind of hang in there and see, well, what are the little pieces, that what role and impact you can have?
I just have this thought that, back to your previous page, one of the things that maybe we learn about doing the right thing is learning how to apologize. And then I've been thinking, well, why is it so hard to apologize? Even if I mean, if it's something between Glenn and me and it's no big deal, why is it hard for me to say I'm sorry?
Right.
And so...
because I'm really judgmental.
Yeah, but it is. Yep. You know, that's one thing that I've learned. The quicker you do it, the better it is. And the more goodies you get out of it, really, yep. When you apologize, people are... stunned, yep. That you would apologize.
And the more often you do it, the easier it gets.
Right.
It's also the other thing.
So that might be a thing in our learning, if we learn that apologies, and that's relational.
Yeah, I think the apologies come when you recognize the interconnectedness,
yeah. Yeah.
And that somehow you do have something to apologize for, that
yes.
You did impact. Many, many offenders that I worked with will say that it was a victimless crime. They really didn't affect anybody, whether it was because there was insurance there or because they don't see...
yeah.
The connections. So the challenge is to make those connections, and you do that by having the people that were affected communicate to the offender. Because I can tell you, it really hurt so and so when you did that. But if it's so and so sitting here saying, it really hurt me
mm-hmm.
when you did that to me,
mm-hmm.
and this is how it impacted my life, that's when the learning happens and when the behavior change begins to shift.
When there's an apology, isn't there kind of the part in that says, I'm apologizing, and I'm also saying I won't do that again? Because if it's just an apology that's empty, and it repeats and repeats, then the apology has no impact at all, does it, or to either one, really?
That would be the act of accountability.
Yeah.
If you're actively accountable for what you've done, you're willing to apologize, which is huge, and then you're willing to take the next steps in regards to making right what you did wrong and making sure that it doesn't happen again.
But as Christian people, we should know we're forgiven people. And so it should be easy to confess and to seek that forgiveness.
Yeah.
But we're not very good learners.
No. And
well, so it was along the line of what she just said. I'm sorry. Is that I'm sorry because I know it'll get me an easier sentence or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Or am I truly sorry?
Right.
How do you determine that?
In a restorative framework, when I do victim offender mediations for folks who are incarcerated, or if an inmate's writing an apology letter to their victim, we're always very clear that this has no impact on your sentence. You're not going to get out early now, you know, because it's a very sensitive area, and we try to always be mindful when we're victim-centered, always making sure that we're not re-victimizing people. That's very important. We want to make sure that that exchange is authentic in some sort of way. You can never guarantee it 100 times, but I operate an apology letter bank at the Department of Corrections of inmates that write letters of apology, and they're screened, and it's typically takes 3 or 4 letters before that apology is really at a place where it says, I did this, you know, I raped you, it was not your fault, I apologize for what I did, I'm not asking for your forgiveness, I'm not asking you to get anything out of this, this is what I've learned, you know, so it's centered.
So before that, 3 or 4 times before it's actually transmitted then, saying that you guys review it and make sure that it comes from the heart and not from the head.
Yeah.
So what do they sound like before the 3rd or 4th time?
Some folks get it right out from the beginning. But sometimes if a judge orders an apology, you will write an apology letter for him for what you did. I've seen apology letters, typically teenage boys, you know, I'm sorry that your face was in the way of my fist when it swam through the air. You know, I'm sorry that you left your purse sitting on your front seat with your door unlocked. You know, duh. That person's not really in that place of accepting full responsibility, nor do they realize the impact of their behavior. So, it takes some learning, and it takes courage, I would say, for these folks who have done harm to get to that place, to be able to realize, whoa, you know, I've done something wrong, I've hurt somebody else. And often it often causes them to have to deal with their own history of victimization, because I don't know that I've ever met an offender who hasn't been a victim in some sort of way and have suffered crap in their life. So, Shelley, and then I'm going to come back to you.
You said something earlier that brought a story to mind, and then I'm looking at this chart and thinking, you know, sometimes it's the victim and the community are the only pieces of the triangle that you kind of have.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Eve Eisner from the Vagina Monologues? Has a story. She went to Bosnia shortly after the war and spent some time in the refugee camps with the women.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that she was told by the community that was there to support the women was, don't make the women talk about what happened to them.
Mm.
Trying to make it a safe place for them to put it behind them and move on. And what they discovered was that some of them didn't need to talk about it.
Right.
They just, but they also needed to move on. And so at the camp that she worked at, there was a tree just a little bit off from the camp that became the safe place.
Yeah.
And so it was the community learning how to truly be supportive to the victims,
mm-hmm.
who some needed to talk, some didn't. Some could talk in that place, but not in the other. And in that situation, you know, the offenders weren't part of the loop,
mm-hmm.
But the community and the victims still had some.
Yeah, and that definitely falls within the realm of being restorative.
Mm-hmm.
You try to really talk about, there's a video that I'm gonna leave here in the village called Help, Hope, and Healing. It's the latest production that's put out by the Office of Victim Services, National Office, and it's victims speaking about the justice system and, you know, how more often than not they're re-victimized by what unfolds within the system. And their voice isn't heard and they're silenced and they're told to get over it. And for those that do need to tell, I mean, the retelling of what happened is a healing process within our brain that actually puts the sequence of events back into order. Because when trauma happens, that all gets messed up. I mean, nothing fits within the time frame in which it happened. And so that retelling over and over and over and over and over is the brain's way, emotional way of actually healing and making sense out of what comes out of that. But how often do you, you know, I hear stories from victims that, especially in crimes of severe violence, where people just don't want to hear about it. You know, that was a year ago, aren't you over that yet?
No.
You know, sort of type situation. And so we try to increase our capacity and our understanding of victims' needs and the effects of trauma. I'm going to come to you in just a second. I want to get this down.
So the offender who comes from a family where the culture of toughness is imbued with physical abuse, those to apologize is just weak. And so this system of restorative justice is working. It has to, you know, giving an offender a chance to just talk about the crime, then to remember how he was scapegoated and abused by one or both parents, and that when the father was acting out his stuff, the mother failed to rescue, failed to say, "Dad, can it, or you're out of here."
Mm-hmm.
And so I work with folks that come from compulsively abusive, and toughness means don't ever talk about your feelings. So you're going upstream against your, a lot of culture.
Yeah.
If the grandfather is the same way,
yeah,
on one side. Anyway, it's really a great process to be open it up. Just to talk about the crime, then
yeah,
talk about the family of origin factors.
Right, and that's where, when we think about these forces in our lives that keep us doing the right thing, we wouldn't want to focus only here, because often this is not a good place for some folks. So we would want to look at, you know, some of the other forces in the society, and maybe making connections to extended family to have some of that impact.
I'm encouraging, one therapist that I went to says, no, you can find a substitute father.
Yeah.
Someone who can, with whom you can form an attachment that has justice in it.
Yeah.
That's a whole new idea.
Yeah. Rebuilding that support network. Emily?
I've been wondering, we've been talking about the confessing or the apologizing. And the church, I think, has taken a step back as a place of confession and forgiveness. It used to be a thing that was done corporately every week, almost without question. And in recent years, that has fallen out of favor. And I've really been struggling with that. And it's fallen out of favor, not from the context of the liturgy, but from the context of the people who don't. I had a parishioner say to me that the reason they go to the contemporary worship service, which never includes confession and forgiveness, is because why would I want to have to confess every week? That just makes me feel bad. And there's this sense of, if we admit to any sense of guilt, if we allow ourselves to have a sense of guilt, and I see guilt as a positive motivator, and I'm not talking about the oppressive kind of guilt that's put on a person.
Yeah.
But our own sense of guilt, when we don't own up to that and address it, in our group we were talking about being emotionally out there, letting it out, we don't let it sits there, and that I think is one of the main motivators that turns to self-loathing and anger and hatred and frustration and fear, and it just sits there and festers. And the church, I think, is one place that used to have a practice of confession, and then you heard forgiveness instantly. Mm-hmm. It was automatic,
mm-hmm.
Which in some people that makes it superfluous. It doesn't mean anything, but it can if we allow it to say, I am really confessing. I don't even know where I've gone wrong necessarily. There are things that, but I know I have things to confess and to let that go. And so I don't know exactly where I'm going with that, but
no.
I lament the loss of the church.
I think there's a byproduct that's important in there as well. You talk about guilt and you talk about forgiveness, and I think the middle ground that falls in here that we often want to run away from is shame.
Yeah.
And what John Braithwaite, a researcher in Australia, talks about is, I mean, shame is just a natural thing. I mean, it's a natural outcome of our being accountable,
mm-hmm.
being honest about what happened. And it's on the journey, hopefully, to forgiveness. But shame isn't a bad thing. We've done bad things with shame. When we people.
Right.
But he talks about a reintegrative shame, which means the folks that represent these positions of control or positive influence on a person's life gets together and say, you know what you did was a bad thing, but we know you're a good person.
Right.
And so if you can make right what you did, come on back home, sort of type thing. That's within a restorative framework. That's just acknowledging, you know, you should feel bad for, I know you feel bad for what you, at least you should feel bad for what you did. But if it's not a reintegrative shaming process, instead it's sort of a demeaning sort of shaming, what you begin to hear is not that I'm a good person, I did a bad thing, I'm a bad person, and I do bad things. I'm a bad person. Well, I'm a bad person. Of course I do bad things.
Right.
And it only makes sense. So suddenly it only makes sense that I do bad things. And for you to expect me to do good things doesn't make any sense. It's not within my realm of possibility because you've already successfully convinced me that I'm a bad person.
Right.
I'm going to check with Ed, and then I'm going to come up to you.
Kind of relating to Emily, there is shame because I've been caught, you know, that happens. But in the case of going to church and confessing, well, if I confess, then the perception Emily has of me may change. Therefore, do I really want to confess and then have her think less of me? You know, so we're caught in that dilemma.
Yeah, if within that framework is somehow admitting guilt means that someone thinks less of you as opposed to thinking more of you.
Yeah.
Recent experience for me is I messed, and I'm going to come back to you. I messed up, I lost my cell phone bill at work, and we're supposed to designate our personal calls and then pay a check. Well, I thought I had turned that bill in. I really did. And so I kind of got on my supervisor and said, you know, I wrote the check hasn't even come back through, what did you do with it? Your office is always a mess. You know, I didn't say that, but in my mind I'm going, you know, can you look for it? I go to finance, and finance says, well, we don't have it. And I say, you know, I gave it to Claudia, and they go, well, Claudia loses stuff. Yeah, I know, you know, and kind of went there. They're like, well, you know, it wasn't me. Well, be darned if about 4 weeks later I didn't find that bill under a pile of stuff in my own queue.
Yes.
And so there I was with this bill and with this check. Moment of truth. Do I put that in the trash can? Because they'd already regenerated another bill for me. Do I just go to let that low, let that lay, sort of type thing? And I go, no, I do this work. This is what I want to be. Took that bill, went right over to Claudia. I apologized to her. And then I sent an email to the two other people that I had communicated about with it saying, I found the bill, it was my fault, I'm really sorry about this, it wasn't Claudia's fault, this and that. People sent emails back, you can't believe, oh my God, I can't believe that you just owned up to that. And, I mean, the surprising thing it was that it was such a shock to people, again, within this professional office setting, that it was surprising to them that someone would own up to a mistake, sort of type thing. But again, you know, you're sitting there and you've got that moment where you just think, all right, I could not lose, you know, maybe I couldn't lose face. People won't think any less of me because right now they all think it's Claudia's fault or whatever. And so I move into going, well, I don't care if they think less or more of me. I want to do what I know I need to do and what's right. And so you move forward. And sometimes it means they go, you've got a lot of integrity. You know, I really appreciate working with you.
And sometimes they say, well, if you clean up your cube, maybe you'd stop losing stuff all the time. I don't know. You have to get to a spot where that external stuff isn't the controlling mechanism in regards to you doing the right thing, making the right decisions.
Well, I had a thought on the system and the offender victim thing, but with and when I mentioned, I think we did make somewhat of a mistake that the wonderful people, wise people in many ways, have put together the Lutheran worship and so forth. They were trying to get us to return to practice we said we wanted to practice from our Reformation days of private confession. So there it is in LBW and everything, but who does it, you know? And it's the assumption was, well, we should be doing that, therefore we don't always need corporate confession. But of course, we're not doing corporate confession, so we really do need corporate confession. But I was thinking about the system, you know, and I hear about these days, you know, when the supposed offender is in fact the victim, has been falsely arrested, you know, and tried and convicted and everything, and whatever number of years later, find out he or she did not do this at all, and then the system seems to just say, oh, okay, whoops. Yeah, and where kind of restorative justice is there any?
That, I mean, that is a craziness. And the worst case scenario is that we're now over 100 people who have been executed who have been deemed innocent from the DNA research that we have. Over 100 people that we've executed in the United States that now we go, whoops, guess they were innocent.
So if
there are a number of people that are being released, but there was a guy, another NPR sort of story where I think he was locked up for 20-some years and then was finally deemed innocent. And in some states, they do now pay a person a per-day amount for every day that they were incarcerated. They will be given some sort of restitution for that. But in many states, it's a, whoops, sorry, see you later.
So how can you have the system practicing, trying to practice restorative justice if they don't themselves do it when they offend?
Oh, right. I am nowhere trying to convince you or anyone that our current formal system is restorative. in its operations. No, I mean, there's efforts and there's ways that I think are making inroads, but no, that is not what our current system is about. And a lot of the societal influences around us aren't about that either. I mean, when we go to another country and bomb them because we feel that they did something wrong to us, I mean, it's
right.
I had a kid, a juvenile that I worked with, and he was in for murder. He was part of a gang killing of, and the kid was a good friend of his, but got caught up in this gang situation, and worked with him for a while. He wanted to meet with the parents of the young man that he had murdered, and the parents wanted to meet with this young man as well, and it was an intense encounter. They were both so afraid, but it was, you talk about holy ground, you talk about being in the midst of a time that just sort of gets suspended and just sort of happens. I get chills as I just sort of reflect back onto it. But the parents gave this young boy a bracelet, and engraved on the bracelet was the word forgiven. And they said, we've lost our son, but we want you to make a life of your own. Live your life for both him and for you. Sort of move forward with this. Incredible, you know, sort of intense moments. And I got so caught up in that moment, I'm trying to think of...
system is not restorative.
Yeah, as we were talking about.
Right.
But even when the system is in the home, you know, mom and dad kind of thing, I think it does great things for everybody, certainly for this child growing up, when, let's say, the dad has lost his temper in an inappropriate way.
Oh, has that ever happened to me?
Anyway, and to come back and apologize to the daughter or son, say, I'm sorry, I was way out of line there.
Absolutely. And that's where I believe the seeds of hope are planted. When we can do that as parents with one another, or when we can do it as a couple, even in front of our kids, and say, you know what, I went off on you, that was wrong, you know, shouldn't have lost my whatever. And I had a correctional officer after one of my trainings came back and told me, well, it was actually during the five-day training, he and his wife had gotten into a big argument about something, and the issue was that well, there was numerous issues, but he really hadn't listened and heard what was going on, and he went off and was in front of the kids, and he went back the next day and apologized at the table with the kids there and explained to them, we have to be accountable for what we've done. So I get excited when they take it out of their work realm and make it, you know, life, because this is about the way we interact in our family, in our communities, everywhere. But yeah, and hopefully we have memories of that happening in our childhood. I mean, the accountability exercise is just going to encourage everyone to think of a time when they did either hold themselves accountable or they were held accountable and it turned out in a good way. You know, when you were able to move through that, because to have that memory or to vision that it can happen makes it more possible. Just like the more often you say, I'm sorry, in an authentic way and clean up, the easier it gets and the more aware you become of situations like that. As a visual thinker, there are a couple of images that I keep in my mind that helps me to remember what restorative justice is all about, what restorative philosophies of justice is about. And so I want to give those to a few of you that are visual thinkers. You've got written stuff for the more literal. But in our current system, we think, not, I don't want to talk about system, but I think even in our way of being with one another, we think that to have behavior change, we either need to react in a punitive way, or if not punitive, then we're being permissive, right? So the fear is if we're too soft on crime, and right now the political arena is probably about over here on this realm of punitive. I mean, we're talking about tough on everything, and we're talking about military might is what happens, and fear is what's going to control and everything. And so we tend to sort of swing between these two in some sort of way. There's some signs that on a justice level, we're actually maybe moving a little more this way, but the motivator of moving this way is economics at this point. We're getting concerned about how much it costs to incarcerate people, so we're being willing to look at some alternatives. That's not a great motivator, but it's at least a little bit of an open door, potentially. In a restorative framework, we say this is kind of just two-dimensional. We're not really stuck on this idea of either being punitive or permissive, that there's really kind of a window of opportunity for ways that we can interact with one another. And so this little continuum sort of gets put here. And when we think about being permissive, try to come up with some quick, easy words that, and again, I keep this image in my mind and I think, okay, am I operating this way or that way? To be extremely punitive, where I'm exerting a lot of control and the person who I'm exerting that control over has very little control or investment into it, a word that sort of comes to mind in regards to that window is I'm doing things to someone, right? I don't want to hear your voice. I don't want to hear anybody's voice. I'm just going to do this to you. This is what you do. That's it. I don't have enough time to talk about this. You can think about it in parenting skills sometimes. Why? Because I said so. That's it. You know, this is not a conversation in a classroom. You know, I don't have time to deal with what happened or hear all about it to the principal's office. You're out of here. You know, I'm going to do this to you. So this idea of doing it to someone. The extreme of being permissive, this box down here, where the amount of control that I'm exerting over someone is high and that person's interest is low, and a window that we don't necessarily want to be into. What would be a word there? We're doing things not to people, but we're doing things for people. Okay? So in a framework where we're not expecting people to be accountable, we're not expecting people to take responsibility or anything else, we're just going to do things for them, for them. You know how they are. We just have to do this for them, sort of that whole idea. Whether it's in a social work realm, or within a corrections realm, or a parenting realm, or whatever sort of realm you want to enter into. So on those two extremes, you're either going to do something to people, or you're just going to do it for them, you know, do the work for them. In restorative window, we say, well, actually, there are a couple of different options. If you don't do it to them or for them, and you just hope that it goes away, let's just hope that it goes away. What are you doing?
Denial.
You're ignoring it. Right. You're in denial also. But sometimes, you know, the parenting, I just sort of picture this in the parenting realm as well. If we just ignore it, maybe she'll get over it, you know, or...
We're going to ignore it.
Yeah.
Ingore.
What's that?
We're going to ignore it.
That's really about spell check. It's just not...
Spell check, it doesn't mean...
There we go.
Markers.
Ignore. So, ideally, in a restorative window, what's left? We're not going to do things to people. We're not going to do things for people.
With.
We're not going to ignore it. We want to create some sort of change.
You work along with. Sorry.
With, exactly. So the goal is to include the stakeholders and the people that are most affected by the situation, to include them as early and as often as possible. You're working with them. It's not about you. It's not about the probation officer saving this kid. It's not about the victim advocate doing everything and making everything right. It's about working with people, creating a safe space and time for their voices to be heard, for their truths to come out, and for us to come together to develop a plan or to make a decision. So I picture this window, if I'm in a meeting or in a decision or at home or wherever, I think, okay, am I in a mode of doing something to someone, for someone? Am I just ignoring it? Where I want to be is doing something with. I want to be with. I want to be inclusive. I want to be part of that process. So that's one window that often pops into mind for me, or one symbol. Another symbol that often gets in my mind, which is kind of fun in conflict situations, is the idea of the interconnectedness that we all have, and that decisions that we're making and choices that we have are affecting everybody else. I think of, you know, within that realm of a circle, you know, to me the circle sort of represents the flowing and the interconnected and everything else. Well, this comes out of a story of a family that was having to make a decision, a really tough decision, and the grandfather was not being very cooperative. And so the family kept trying to, you know, include the grandfather here, and the grandfather would say, fine, you all make the decision, I'm out of here, I'm not part of it. So grandpa would go, boop, I'm out of here, forget it. So you have a choice at that time. Do you just continue without grandfather, or do you think, all right, the visual in a restorative way is, how do I draw the circle bigger? How do I make this process, how do I make this whatever, big enough so that it includes grandpa again? Okay, so how do we change so that we're doing it with? Grandpa might sort of get keen to that pretty quick and say, forget it, I'm out of here. Well, what's the challenge? Nope, I'm out of here. Nope, I'm out of here. Nope. So this is a visual that I often use when I'm in encounters or meetings and I think, okay, is everybody here? Nope, that person's out. All right, how do we step back, kind of include them again? How do we expand this? I also use this diagram when I think about the way we currently respond to conflict in schools, you know, in a non-restorative way. A teacher says, you know what? I'm sick of you in my classroom. All you do is disrupt everybody else. You're out of here. Okay? So my realm is my classroom. Well, the reality is the kid's still in the school, right? Right? So the school gets sick of them and says, forget it. You're out of here. Well, they're still in the community. Okay? So all you're doing is you're just passing on the responsibility. You know, well, no, they're out of the community. We're going to send them to a state institution. Well, they're still part of the state. Well, you know what? We're sending you out of the state. You know, you're going to Pennsylvania. That's where we send a lot of youth because it's really cheap to house kids in Pennsylvania. So they send them to Pennsylvania. Well, and so I've argued until we can find a way to send people to the moon to not deal with them, why not deal with them the first time? In an effective way, so that we don't keep passing the problem on to somebody else and think that it's somebody else's issue, let them deal with it. Why don't we walk into that challenge and accept the responsibility of dealing with it initially and try to figure out how can we all learn, how can we all change from it? So those are a few visuals that sort of work for me really well when I'm sitting in meetings or if I'm having a conflict, and think about that. Emily?
I would say the reason we don't is economics. We do not have the time to deal with people.
We don't dedicate the time. We have the time.
Well, in a school of over 2,000 kids and one teacher to every 35 kids, mm-hmm. I would argue that a teacher does not have the time.
Yeah.
That's an economics piece.
Yeah.
So I go again to a big part of our problem with our justice is that we live in communities that are too large to handle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we lock ourselves into the illusion that we don't have enough time. But there are teachers in classrooms that have stopped and have said, this is insane. This is insane. And I will use restorative measures in school. Within the education system, they call it restorative measures, because restorative justice sounds too criminal justice sort of realm. So I know teachers that will use a circle process to have the kids check in. I know teachers that refuse to send their kids out of the classroom and will stop their lesson plan or tie their lesson plan into the conflict that you two are having with one another. Let's talk about how your conflict is affecting the rest of the classroom. And the hope is if you could realize the impact of your messing around, it's going to change, as opposed to, okay, quick and easy, you're out of here. Well, you know what? You're coming back to the classroom. If we just ignore, pretend, oh, she's back, okay, that's okay. Oh, she's still messing up, you're out of here again. Okay, oh, everything's better. Oh, now she's back. What are we learning? What are we learning? And talking about economics, eventually that kid's probably gonna end up in the correctional system, in the juvenile justice system, eventually in the correctional system. 70% of inmates are illiterate in our prisons across the United States. Talk about a connection to the schools. 70%. And our school system is modeled largely after our criminal justice system in the same sort of realm, based on a lot of the same things. So the challenge is, you know, again, how do we reclaim that time? How do we realize that in a McDonald's society where we want things to be quick and fast and over, that all we're doing is just sort of pushing it off until later? If we use the framework of sort of long-term investment, where the time and energy that I spend now is going to pay off much better in the long run. If we can reduce the amount of recidivism, offenders recommitting crimes, not only do we reduce the number of people that are victimized, we also reduce the amount of resources we have to put in to housing someone again within our justice system. Oh, I have an 8-minute video and I missed it, so.
Well, it's a buffet lunch.
It's a buffet. Are you willing to hang for 8 minutes to
sure.
see this quick summary? It's,
yeah.
It's really good. It's put out by the Presbyterian Church. It's called Restoring Justice, and
bottom right,
play.
Hello, I'm Jim Marks. Our criminal justice system works in courtrooms like this to answer three basic questions. What laws were broken, who broke them, and how should we punish the lawbreaker? The system is well designed to answer those questions, but if justice means restoring peace to our communities, then the system is failing. Failing because it is unable to make our streets safe or reduce the fear that many live with daily. Failing because fear often leads victims to seek revenge. And revenge to most victims means prison. But prison has proved ineffective as a way to reduce crime and fear. In the United States, we now hold more people in prison than ever before. Yet crime and fear are still rampant. And the cost of building and operating more and more prisons is bankrupting other vital public policies. Out of the faith community came a growing concern that justice as retribution or revenge is not only failed policy, but also conflicts with basic beliefs. So, from the faith community, from the academic world and victim advocates, from police and correction officers and officers of the court who have seen the failures of retributive justice, a new way of thinking is beginning to emerge. It's called restorative justice, and it asks one basic question. How do you make victims of crime, offenders, and their communities whole again?
I'm going to do whatever it takes. I mean, the worst thing for me is that seeing all of you here, knowing that some of you are mad at me and some of you, I mean, absolutely hate me for what's happened, and some are scared of me. I don't want anybody to be scared of me.
A victim and offender meeting face to face to resolve the hurt. That's restorative justice. Men serving time by cutting firewood to provide fuel for the poor and earning back a place in their community. That's restorative justice.
Are you trying to get it in?
No, I'm trying to get the junior counsel.
An ex-offender having learned from his mistakes helps an at-risk teenager. That's restorative justice.
I'm writing you this letter to let you know how very sorry I'm for hurting you.
the obligation for offenders to say they're sorry. That's restorative justice.
Restorative justice says that crime is basically about harm. It's a violation of people and relationships between people. So instead of defining crime as breaking the law, it defines crime as violating people. Instead of saying the state of the victim, restorative justice understands that people and communities are the victims, that real people are hurt. And so justice ought to be about establishing needs and obligations so things can be made right in some way.
There's an awful lot of rhetoric out there articulating hatred for the offender and wanting to warehouse the offender, but the people articulating that position are not recognizing that 95% of the offenders are coming back to live among us. If we make it impossible for them to find a place to rent, if we make it impossible for them to find a place to be employed, if we create an environment where it's okay to hate, then all we're going to be doing as a society, as a community, as a criminal justice system, is perpetuating crime and violence.
To incarcerate someone for a year cost anywhere, conservative figure, $15,000 to $22,000, and that's very conservative, and I'm not factoring in all the other costs. For that kind of money, we could send people to Morehouse or to Harvard. It just does not seem to make sense to continue to spend millions of dollars incarcerating people and run a 65% recidivist rate.
And putting people in jail has just proved to us that it just doesn't work in all cases. There are cases, as I say, there's no question, where we have to protect the community, but there are so many instances that it just doesn't solve a problem. And it just simply creates more problems.
There is one thing that the public hates, we all hate, that is someone coming back out of our prisons and offending again. And we say, well, what was that all about? We spent all of that time, all of that money, waste of lives, and we've come back out with a person who's not restored, you know, a person who is going back into the same life. And that's the worst case scenario for any of us. So there has to be something better in its place.
For retributive justice, the three questions are, what law's been broken, who done it, what do they deserve? For restorative justice, the three questions might be, who's been hurt, what are their needs, whose obligations are they? It takes us quite a different direction.
Restorative justice is not about being soft on crime. It's about being real and focusing upon the real damage, and not just continuing this kind of trail them, nail them, jail them mentality, which is totally, totally offender-focused and offender-driven, and which ironically, as I've said before, it just keeps victims on the sideline and does not deal with their needs.
So, that video is about 53 minutes long. I'll leave it out if somebody wants to. I don't know if they have capabilities of viewing it on their own.
On the Creekside.
On the Creekside? Okay, if somebody wants to see more of it, but kind of a quick summary, and I'll let you go eat lunch.
I just have one thought that is coming to a head right now regarding someone who worked in the prison system who was letting me know, or those of us who were discussing with, how much of an economic power the prison system is in many countries, counties,
yep,
cities, and how they need to have the prison system operate on this type of level because it generates so many jobs, so much revenue.
Absolutely. The newest prison that went up in Minnesota, communities were bidding. I mean, of course. You know, build it here. Finally, jobs. And to become a guard, you may not even need a high school diploma.
You drive through Arizona, you see prison after prison.
Yep. Private corporations are moving into the realm and building private prisons. Yeah. Why? Because it's a huge market.
Prisons have become like a franchise?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a huge French corporation that's paired up with some American corporations. We have one small private prison in Minnesota. We're trying to keep them up, but they're going up all over the place.
It's a major part of Washington State's budget, I know, with all the prison system.
Yeah.